Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. For those of you that are vegans or are following the things that are going on in social media, it's Meatless Monday. What a better way to celebrate than with someone like Kim O'Donnell as she discusses her latest collection of mouth-watering recipes in her book called The Meat Lover's Meatless Celebrations, Year-Round Vegetarian Feast You Can Really Sink Your Teeth Into. This book, I have to say, is coming at such a perfect time in my life, especially since I've had such a hateful relationship with tofu, and there's, in my opinion, only so many things that you can do with tofu to make it palatable, especially if you need the protein in your diet, which we all do. It's important to keep it interesting. It's important to do things that make you want to enjoy the meal as you would when you were consuming meat, if you have made the transition, or just to make the meals enjoyable, and also meals that you want to be able to share with your family, with friends, and even with colleagues. So I think for those of you that are not vegans, that are looking at different options that are healthier, also are gluten-free, I think you're going to enjoy everything that she's written in her book, The Meat Lover's Meatless Celebrations. So I would like to welcome to the show Kim O'Donnell.
Hey, how are you? Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. I tell you, the recipes that you put together are just fantastic. I love so many of these recipes, and one in particular, the pumpkin pudding with molasses cookies. Mm. It's such a great recipe. I wish I had pumpkins that were growing in the garden right now so that I could make this. So now I'm going to see if I can find pumpkin. Can I use frozen pumpkin for this recipe?
You could. The only thing I would say about the frozen pumpkin is to make sure that you drain it really well after it thaws. Something that a lot of us don't think about after we freeze fruit and some vegetables is that there's going to be some water release. So that would be the only thing I'd think about. Otherwise, you'd be good to go.
Thank you. I will definitely do that. Before we get into my list of questions for you, can you tell our audience about yourself and what made you decide to write this particular book?
Sure. This is my second book. My first book came out in the fall of 2010, and that's called The Meat Lover's Meatless Cookbook. And they are connected. They obviously both have the same prefix, Meat Lover's Meatless. And I will say right off the top is that I'm not 100% vegetarian. And I don't know if I'll ever get there, but I will tell you that I went from being a daily meat eater, like so many other Americans, to now about 70% vegetarian. And this has been done in a very incremental fashion over the last 5 years. I have a history of family heart disease, and both my father and my grandmother died of heart attacks at a very young age. And so this idea of cholesterol, lipid profiles, all that kind of stuff was came to our attention when I was just 16, but it was in the 80s when all that was happening, and so the medical advice at that point was, you know, sort of switch around your saturated fats, not really get rid of them. So I'll give you a couple of examples, like instead of butter, it would be margarine. Instead of whole milk, it would be skim. You know, no more bologna sandwiches, but oh, you can have roast turkey. But never a conversation about, oh, maybe you ought to eat more vegetables or whole grains, or I didn't know what a legume was, you know. So that was sort of the approach, and it felt kind of punitive because we were told, oh, well, you can't have bacon and eggs anymore, or, you know, no more ice cream. And so, again, never a conversation about moderation. So anyway, flash forward into my 30s, I had gone to cooking school. I was working at the Washington Post, writing a daily food column for them on their website. And I, with all my experience and background, I still was never really putting my health first. It was more experiential and, hey, I'll try this and share it with my readers. And my cholesterol and lipid levels were really very much like a roller coaster, and I knew I needed to get consistent. And it wasn't a problem so much about not liking vegetables, but kind of getting sort of on the stick. And around, it was very early in 2008, and I had found out about this public health campaign called Meatless Monday. And at that point, it was still very much a fledgling nonprofit that very few people knew about, kind of in academic circles. It started out in the year 2003, and the idea at that point was to help Americans reduce their saturated fat intake by 15% by the year 2010. And the way they looked at it was daily meat eaters, if you take one day off from meat, you're giving your body, at that point they were only talking about health, they weren't talking about the environment. They said, take one day off, you're giving your body 15% reduction. And I thought, wow, well, that's easy. Win-win, right? So I thought that was pretty interesting. I knew that was something I could do. And so I shared this idea with my readers, and everyone was pretty enthusiastic, but they said to me, we don't want philosophy, we don't want a debate, we want tools. And that is really what spurred me on to start featuring a meatless recipe feature in my column. And I actually was the first Meatless Monday blogger on record. And what was interesting about it is that I really enjoyed it. You know, it got me on the stick, it got my husband on the stick, but I was now accountable to my readers, and I got them involved. So it got me consistent, and it wasn't a chore. And so within a few months, one day off from meat became 2 days off from meat. And as a chef, it opened me up culinarily. I started to dabble in other cuisines. So, okay, so this fueled the fire for my first book. And the first book essentially is a different menu for every week of the year if you wanted to put this idea into practice. All four seasons, cooking where, you know, based on wherever you live, and taking a day off. And very much like everyday style cooking. So the new book is what I think of as like 2.0. Meaning what I discovered was, okay, it was easy for us to do this on an everyday basis at home, but when it came to entertaining and having friends over or any of the major holidays, I kind of found myself falling back into what I call my roast beast comfort zone. And I think we could all relate to that. You know, what's Thanksgiving without the turkey? You know, the Christmas ham or the duck, St. Patty's Day with the corned beef and the cabbage. And I thought, well, geez, you know, why couldn't we put on all these wonderful, why can't we do all these wonderful occasions without the roast beef? And that's what set me on course to put together the new collection. It's kind of a long story, but I wanted to sort of give some context here. And so the new book has 26 different menus for all kinds of happy moments in our lives, from Thanksgiving to 4th of July to, you know, Mardi Gras, which we just celebrated, Mother's Day, all the fun things. And the desserts, there are actually desserts in this book, as you mentioned, the pumpkin pudding, have some kind of healthful tweak to them. Sometimes they're vegan, sometimes they're not. And that sort of brings me to this whole thing, is that in making this food and developing the recipes, delicious first, meatless second. You know, I didn't want to have anything sort of gratuitously meatless, just to fill in the gaps in my book.
Well, what I admire about your recipes is the fact that the recipes consist of foods that you actually either you can grow yourself or they're completely unprocessed. You really make the person who's preparing the particular recipe reconnect with that food. So in other words, there's nothing processed in there. It's a list of, or it's a collection of different recipes where you're using really great ingredients that work together to produce a really fantastic result. And
well, thank
that's
you.
What I admire, because there are a lot of vegan books out there that will encourage you to use this, that, the other thing, and it's all processed stuff that you buy at the market, and I'm not a big supporter of preparing food like that. I appreciate people such as yourself that say, well, you know what, you need, you know, this, and this in for the recipe, and this is how you prepare it. And the beauty of it is a lot of these foods can be foods that you grow in your own garden and have preserved. And you also are an expert on canning and preserves.
Yeah, I'm not a master preserver. I haven't gotten that route yet, you know, as far as, like, getting my certificate. But in 2000, I live, as you mentioned, I live in Seattle, but had lived on the East Coast for many years. I'm originally from the Philadelphia area and lived in Washington, D.C. for many, many years. And 4.5 years ago, my husband and I moved to Seattle. And, you know, knowing very few people here, I got on Twitter and started to meet folks in my new neighborhood, particularly interested in folks in the food community. And it was 2009, and I had heard about this cool canning project happening in the Bay Area called Yes, We Can. And what they were doing was every month, they would have a canning class for the community featuring one ingredient. So it would be like, okay, hey, this week we're, you know, this month we're doing cucumbers, cucumbers only. And then the next class would be tomatoes, if, you know, the tomatoes were in. And I just liked it. For whatever reason, it really appealed to me. And I thought, well, what the heck? Let me just see who else is out there who's interested in getting more skilled in canning. And I had only done it once at that point, and it was not, I would not call it the most successful endeavor. We drank a lot of wine and listened to Donna Summer records, but, you know, we had a lot to learn, you know? And anyway, so I just said something to the effect like, hey, who's interested in learning how to can? Look at this cool project that's going on. And I got to tell you, June, careful what you wish for, because people are coming out of the woodwork. And all of a sudden, I've got people from all over the country saying, yeah, I want to learn how to can. What are you thinking about? And there was so much interest, not just in Seattle, but around, you know, all across the country, that we decided, this group of us in Seattle, we decided to meet in person. How, what do you think about that? Digital, you know, social media, we finally meet in real life. And we realized that we had something here, and I kept envisioning sort of a simultaneous show of cans, if you will. So I was thinking, what if we had a day or series of days where people around the country were simultaneously canning, putting up their own food wherever they lived, whether they were having a home canning party or they were teaching someone else how to cook. And so that's kind of how Canning Across America was formed. And we still look at it as a collective of food lovers, gardeners, cooks, folks from all walks of life who are interested in sort of preserving this lost art of putting up food. And it's mainly peer-to-peer teaching. You know, we're really stressing, you know, safe home food preservation, not doing anything too wacky. And, you know, connecting with our own food shed, whether we grow it or we're working with the local farmers. So canning is a big part of my life now. I can't imagine it any other way. And I knew in the new book I was going to have to put some, you know, a mini preserving section in there, because it's been integrated into the stuff that I do.
It's so incredibly important, Kim. And thank you so much for doing that. at this particular point, so many Americans are frustrated because we do not have labeling of GMOs in our food. And people know that, okay, well, the big agrochemical giants are not – they're going to do whatever they have to see to it that they can keep us in the dark for as long as they can. So really the only solution is to grow your own food, preserve it, and make that connection directly. I mean, there are some really great certified organic, non-GMO companies out there, like Eden Foods and Nature's Path. I think the world of both Michael Potter and Aaron Stevens, really two fantastic people that really walk the walk or talk the talk and walk the walk. But when it comes to our food in general, it's getting to the point where it's ridiculous. And the only solution is to grow your own food, preserve it, and follow recipes such as this collection of recipes in the Meat Lovers Meatless Celebrations, and take the matter into your own hands so that you can understand what you're putting into your body, what you're putting into your family's body, and also look at it from the economic perspective that this is something that we really need to do in order to have healthier lives, but also to have accountability for what's going on with the food that we use. And so what you're doing is very important. And, you know, not everybody has a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt or an uncle or even a parent that knows how to can. So I think the whole concept of a peer-to-peer type situation is fantastic. And even with the way that your classes were conducted where you did all tomatoes, I mean, let's face it, when you grow tomatoes and they're ripe, it's not like you have one tomato. You usually have more tomatoes and you know what to do with. So I think that was smart as far as whoever organized the activities. They understood gardening. And the same thing with cucumbers. I mean, how many things can you really do with cucumbers? But, you know, you'd be surprised. I mean, that's why the innovation in the recipes, and sometimes it's an old recipe that's been in the family, and you just make it a little bit more modern so that it's you're not making, you know, an army load of whatever the recipe calls for, but that's something that is suitable for your own personal needs or for your family's needs. So I think what you're doing is really in tune at the right time, right place with what's going on with the food movement, the organic food movement in America at this particular time.
Well, canning and preserving is one way of connecting. You know, it's pretty hard to can by yourself. I mean, one, it's not that fun because it's a bit of an octopus. It's kind of a multifaceted, you know, kitchen project.
You don't want to drink alone.
And you don't want to drink alone, but seriously, it gets you. There's so many wonderful things about it. I mean, I think about it as sort of meditation in an interesting sort of way. I mean, yes, it connects you with the seasons and your local food shed, whether you're growing the food or whether you're going to your farmer's market or you're getting, you know, a CSA box. It's connecting you with that. But it also forces you to slow down a little bit. You know, we're always in a rush, right? And canning, you know, you need to block out 3 hours. There's just no way to make shortcuts on that. And so it means putting down that electronic device and focusing. Canning's not hard, but it does require your undivided attention. And so I know. How about that? And so that's one of the things that I love about it is that you've got to slow down. And you're focusing on the food and you're focusing on the community because you're working with somebody else. You're maybe catching up on each other's lives, what's happening. And you are together creating something out of that. So there is truly fruit of your labor. And you get to share it. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. And, you know, I have, you know, jars. I'll just tell you a quick story. I got to know a farming couple at my local farmer's market. Here in Seattle, we're really lucky because, you know, there might be one day in the week when we don't have a farmer's market going in the growing season. And it's pretty incredible. And I know in the New York area, it's much like that. So anyway, I got to know this couple. There were these major forest fires in the central part of the state last summer. It was August, and it was obviously due to the drought, climate change, all of that, and they lost their house on the property.
Wow.
And they were able to save the farm, but they, you know, were basically sleeping on the floor in their office. And she was 4 months pregnant at the time. You know,
wow.
This just about broke my heart. And, you know, it was interesting because I liked them very much, but, you know, it was, and I relied on them for certain things. I really liked their peppers and their cucumbers, and then they were getting these tomatoes to come in. But what happened at that moment when I found out about the fire is that the two of us, the guy, the husband and I, connected. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to write this guy a check for the fire fund. I'm going to buy his food because he needs to pay his bills. And he, in turn, taught me about a Czech heirloom tomato called the Stupis that he said was great for making tomato sauce. So we taught each other something. We gave each other something. And I made at least 20 quarts of his sauce. And I guess I thought about him and his wife the whole time. You know, so, and then I got to share the story with the friends that were making the sauce with me that August. So it can really be about these connections, you know, when you do preserve. There are wonderful stories and moments that come out of that. And I have been, you know, we use a couple quarts of that sauce a month in my cooking. You know, I'm getting sad because the stock is getting low, you know, and it's only still late February. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that can come about when you preserve. And I think, you know, when you talk about growing your own food, and I think, you know, it is an ideal. I mean, you know, I have a container garden. I would love to be able to grow more of my food. But I think what I would say to folks is that do what you can do. Take one thing. You know, if it's growing a pot of herbs or three pots of herbs, do that. You know, you're right. It's about this connection, and it's the empowerment that happens when you get involved. When we stay passive, we stay out of the kitchen, we don't grow anything, we don't put up something that's seasonal, we remain in that very passive role, and so we stay disconnected from all that's going on, and there's way too many serious things happening in the food system. It's absolutely imperative for us to at least dip our toe in and get involved in this way. And it can be voting by just getting into the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, Kim, the way that you wrote this book, it was so beautiful. You really can tell that this is straight from your heart. It's not something that's fabricated or assembled. As many books about that feature plant-based recipes often are. Your book really comes straight from the heart. You talk about what you need. Here's what you do. Pictures are just fantastic. And these are all recipes that are also kid-friendly. You can make these together as a family.
Yep.
And I think when you do cook together, and that's quality time that you're spending together, you have that exchange. And also to be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor and to be able to say, okay, well, you know, we grew this in the garden, and
mm-hmm.
we're using this, and this. And then if you do it together with other families, or if you're working together with some friends,
mm-hmm.
what I always have appreciated is when I have friends that grow different things, and then we decide mm-hmm. that we're going to can or preserve, you know, specific things together, it's
mm-hmm.
nice to get that little bit of a mixture, if you will.
Oh, sure.
From their gardens.
Oh, yeah, that's fun. I mean, yeah, I mean, there are tons of ways for folks to connect. And I'd even say to somebody who, you know, even with cooking, you know, if you find yourself overwhelmed, start with one day a week to cook a home meal. You know, start there. Then move in that direction. I mean, cooking is contagious. You know, there's all these wonderful things that happen and unfold when you're in the kitchen. And, you know, it doesn't matter if there's one of you or five of you or something in between. You know, you're not just nourishing yourself. You're nourishing your soul. You're all these wonderful conversations come about. You learn new things, and you connect the dots. And, you know, I get frustrated when I hear people tell me that they don't have time to cook, but they have time to watch television or get on, you know, on the web or, you know, and there is, we need to make the time. And if we set aside 1 hour or we find a way in our schedule to do it on the weekend so that we are reheating and repurposing homemade food throughout the week, you know, that's going to make you feel better. It's going to make you feel empowered, too. And I always say just start gradually because eventually you'll be cooking a whole lot more than you were. I mean, you know, this past summer, economic, health, knowing what goes into your food. You know, this summer my mother was visiting me from the Philadelphia area, and she came out for a visit, and she noticed that I had granola in the cabinet, and she said, you know, she was making some for breakfast, and she said, wow, this is really good. And I said, well, that's my homemade granola. I have a recipe for granola in the new book. And she said, wow, how difficult is this? It's not difficult at all. And so I sent her the recipe so she could make it when she got home. And she, 2 weeks later, she called me, and she was so excited because she made her own batch of granola. Now, that may seem like old hat for folks who are already, you know, very skilled in the kitchen, but this was a huge moment for my mom. Because what happened was, not only was she proud of herself and it tasted good and she had this new treat for breakfast, she lives with a man who would rather have sausage links for breakfast. He now started eating the granola. But the other part that was just I loved is that she started to notice, well, I can buy my oats in the bulk section and they're going to cost this versus buying them in the bag. And wow, did you ever notice how much prepackaged granola cost? And, oh, I'm going to switch out the raisins for dry cranberries and all these wonderful things. So it's this connecting of the dots just by making a little batch of granola. And, you know, we all can do that. We need to brush ourselves off. You know, just making something simple can really kind of change your tune.
And it always tastes so much better.
Yep.
And you've done this with a number of your recipes. I just want to ask you quickly about your carrot fennel soup. It's interesting. This is what you, if it's okay, I want to read this to the audience.
Oh, sure.
You wrote, I love the idea of carrot soup, but I'm usually disappointed by watery, one-dimensional orange broth. With the addition of fennel, the soup doesn't scream fennel. Rather, it adds depth of flavor, and the lone sweet potato is there for the body. The fennel seed topper is a really nice surprise and pulls all of the flavors together. I couldn't agree more. The fact of the matter is that when you purchase the ready-to-eat or heat-and-serve type soups, it's always watery. And
mm-hmm.
I'm so grateful that you wrote your own personal thoughts for this recipe and also provided such an amazing recipe. I mean, fennel is delicious, but once again, depends upon what you're using it in because it is overpowering.
Yeah, and I wanted to make soups. I'm a big believer, you know, you can make all these wonderful vegetable purees and not have to add dairy cream. There's no reason to. I mean, it does give a voluptuous feel to it, but I just find it to be unnecessarily rich. And so adding a sweet potato to that soup gives it all the lovely body that you wouldn't even know. And it's something you might already have, you know, in the crisper or in the, you know, stored somewhere. And then you're getting even more beta carotene and more loveliness. So it's fun to play around. And the toasted fennel seeds are wonderful at the end. It just gives it that extra little flavor zip. So it's not hard, and you can get those ingredients at your supermarket, no problem, and off you go.
Kim, it has been wonderful talking to you about all the things that you've not only learned but are doing, especially with your own fan base. Could you please share with our audience your website?
Oh, thank you. Yes, my website is kimodonnell.com.
Kim, thank you so much. And folks, thank you for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.